Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled The USA in Transition, From Here to Where. This talk is delivered by U.S. Ambassador Ms. Molly Bordonaro.
Good evening, Your Excellency, U.S. Ambassador Bordonaro, Ms. Valentina Kassar, colleagues and students. Allow me to thank you for turning up this evening, even if I must admit that it's not the best time of the year to have public lectures when we should be all rushing around the shops, getting our Christmas shopping organized. Nonetheless, it is great to be able to meet up and discuss such an important issue, the USA in transition, from here to where, together with other related themes, namely the roots of USA-Malta relationship and the role of young people in the processes of change, which I am pretty sure the youth and community studies students will be raising later on. To start off, I would like to share this extract adapted from the website of the U.S. Embassy in Malta. It says the United States and Malta have a partnership that spans centuries. From 1796, when the young United States of America named its first consul to Malta, to 1805, when Malta played a key role in supporting American ships active in the Barbary War, to 1943, when General Eisenhower signed an armistice with Italian Marshal Pietro Badoglio in the Grand Harbor, to 1964, when the United States was one of the first nations to open an embassy in newly independent Malta, to 1989, when President George H.W. Bush and Soviet President Gorbachev held a historic meeting aboard the Maxim Gorky in Marsa Shlog Bay on the 3rd December 1989, that marked the end of the Cold War. The United States and Malta have shared many historic events, even though so different in size, demography, and culture, an issue which I am sure will be analyzed further on by Valentina. Going back to today's theme, I suppose that during this public lecture, a question we need to ask ourselves is the same one Markov, in his paper Transition to Democracy, asked. That is, transition from what to what? The U.S. for many represents the struggle to have stronger democracies, an unyielding civil and human rights agenda, and an enthusiasm to see through the values of social equality. I believe objectives that even little Malta has done so much to trail. Democracy is in a bite is an invitation to change in certain instances and calculate the achievements our communities have worked so hard to obtain, but with respect and representation as two key underlying values. This public lecture takes place in a climate of convulsive change. The new political administration in the USA is getting underway, with millions around the world hopeful and expecting for the first time in decades that world politics will really bring about the much-needed changes. At the same time, the global economy keeps sliding into a major recession with corollaries no one can predict. The fluctuation in oil prices is mind-boggling for all politicians and policymakers alike. The credit crunch keeps chewing into institutions' resources. This is a turbulent context. Why are we here? The way I see it, university is a global intellectual community that needs to be re-empowered to create a public space for the production of new knowledge, a site for the critical exchange and contestation through which new insights and approaches are advanced, and hopefully quickly so. But enough of me. Let me invite Ms. Valentina Kassar to give us an exposé of some major debates surrounding U.S. politics, strategies, and policies. Ms. Kassar is a lecturer with the Department of International Relations of the Faculty of Art. Among the themes she's particularly interested in, there are the foreign policy of the USA and Russia, European political history, Middle East politics, and India-Pakistan relations. She has held high-ranking posts in the Ministry for Rural Affairs and the Environment, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Office of the Refugee Commissioner. She has completed her master's in Aberdeen, and her dissertation title was Terrorism and European Security Threats and Counter Threats.
Thank you, Dr. Tappardi. As Dr. Tappardi mentioned, I'll be talking about the roots of Maltese U.S. relations. I would begin by looking at the Liberty Bell. The Liberty Bell represents one of the most prominent symbols of U.S. independence and the values that the United States stands for. Liberty, justice, freedom, these are the values that the United States has upheld and continues to uphold as those that should serve as guiding principles not only in domestic and national politics, but also in its foreign policy. The Liberty Bell doesn't only represent the independence of the US and the values that it stands for. It also symbolizes the very foundations on which US-Maltese relations have been based. When the Liberty Bell needed to be recast after it cracked by a stroke of its clapper, when being tested, it was as described by Isaac Norris, who was then the Speaker of the Pennsylvania Assembly, a native of the Isle of Malta, who had recast the bell before it was hung in 1753. This was John Pass, whose name was most likely an adaptation of the Maltese surname Patch. And he, together with his colleague John Snow, recast the bell. They were both established ironmongers in Pennsylvania at the time. And they are both depicted in this painting, the bell's first note, which is found in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. Now, this early link between Malta and the United States reflects the future of Maltese U.S. relations that was to follow and the very foundations on which this relationship would be built. On the one hand, shared values and a shared vision of an international community, which have allowed for the strong cultivation of political and economic relations, and on the other hand, the binding link of migration that has taken place across the Mediterranean and across the Atlantic and across generations as well, which represents one of the strongest ties between the two countries. Now, the pull of the American dream was one which the Maltese were not immune to. The dream that was described as a dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. A dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. And this is the American dream that attracted the Maltese and so many other migrants to its shores, and it's also the dream that is being revived once again with the election of Barack Obama. Thus, the roots of U.S.-Maltese relations go long beyond the establishment of diplomatic relations in 1964, as already mentioned by Dr. Atsopardi, but even date back to the migration that began in the mid-18th century to territories that today form part of the United States. Migration was encouraged and took place for a number of reasons, including population growth and employment opportunities. And over the years, Maltese communities settled primarily in areas like New Orleans, San Francisco, Detroit, and New York. In fact, according to Malta's ambassador to the United States, Mr. Mark Michele Farrugia, it is estimated that today there are up to 200,000 Maltese Americans, if one also includes second-generation Maltese. The fact that Maltese migrants were present during the founding decades of the United States of America means that the Maltese have inevitably contributed to the weave that makes up the rich fabric that is the United States. Names like Joseph Calleja and Doris Dekker Kopp are well known to us all. It's not only within the field of entertainment that Maltese Americans have made contributions to the political, culture, and economic development of the USA. Two of my favorite stories are Joseph Spiteri, who was a shoemaker who emigrated to the United States in the 1950s and went on to found S.P. Terry, which is one of the highest-selling professional ice skating boots in the United States. Frank Zub, who was of Maltese descent, was served as the energy czar under President Ford during the 1970s. So businessmen, doctors, school teachers, policemen, members of the U.S. Army and Marine Corps who served and fought in the name of the United States, these are just some of the roles that Maltese Americans play within U.S. society today. So it's a human link that provides the very foundations on which Maltese-U.S. relations have been built, and the family ties that provide an excellent bridge forever prospering relations, and it's within the community level that the roots for U.S.-Maltese relations have been set. This influence naturally goes both ways. How many of us identify with American sitcoms and cinema and American humor, American literature, American news? How many of us felt like we had a vested interest when a U.S. president was being elected? And how many of us felt a sense of shock and horror when the Twin Towers collapsed on September 11, 2001? And how many of us feared for the safety of friends and family who lived and worked in the area and who were involved in the rescue effort on that fateful day? So these are the ties that bind us together. In the light of this, it's also worth noting the strategic objectives of Malta's foreign policy, one of which is to network effectively with the Maltese abroad, where it is acknowledged that Malta must continue to strengthen its ties with people who are of Maltese descent, and that consolidation of existing links between Malta and its overseas community is of mutual benefit. Now, this isn't to say that we'll be seeing the rise of a Maltese lobby like we've seen the rise of an Israel lobby or an Indian lobby rising to the forefront of U.S. politics. But for any of you who have been fortunate enough to visit a Maltese club in the United States, you'll know that any community could do with stealing a page out of our rule book. They have mastered the art of assimilating within a community and adapting to the language and culture while simultaneously retaining the cultural affiliation, appreciation and loyalty to their country of origin. And the reason for which this is possible brings us to the second factor on which Maltese-US relations have been based: common values, and with this a shared vision of the international community based on peace and prosperity. Now, it's also worth noting, again, like Dr. Andrew Atsopardi already pointed out, that the diplomatic relations between the United States and Malta date back before official recognition in 1964, but even to the opening of one of the first consular offices in 1796. The importance of these bilateral relations has been highlighted through various instances throughout our shared history. During the Second World War, Malta played a central role in the defeat of the Axis powers, which led to President Roosevelt's visit in Malta in December of 1943, where he donated the illuminated scroll to the people and defenders of Malta on behalf of the people of the United States. A clearer version of the text is here. He saluted the island of Malta, its people and defenders, who in the cause of freedom and justice and democracy throughout the world have rendered valorous service far above and beyond the call of duty. In any relationship, there are always ups and downs, and in Maltese-US relations, this low point came during the 1970s when the Maltese government reoriented its foreign policy to one of neutrality and non-alignment. Yet the nature of this low point and the way in which relations were managed and kept on course during these times is indicative of, aside from the Cold War context in which this took place, of firstly the steadiness of the foundations on which this relationship had been built, and secondly the mutual respect that exists between the two countries. And in hindsight, one might argue that the decision that Malta took to adopt a policy of neutrality allowed it to make its small yet landmark contribution to the coming about of the end of the Cold War. Thus, Malta was not only instrumental in defeating the enemy in times of war, it was also instrumental in building bridges, as it did during the moment that some have argued symbolized the end of the Cold War during the Malta summit in December 1989. And this was historical as an event, because it was also the summit during which, for the first time, the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union addressed a joint press conference. Now, moreover, during his time here, President Bush echoed his predecessor's appreciation for Malta's efforts in international affairs and praised the respect with which democratic practices were held in Malta. Back in 1989, President Bush and Prime Minister Fenek Adame, and I quote, expressed particular satisfaction that relations between Malta and the United States historically had been strengthened in recent years and were presently very close. Over the past 19 years, relations have continued to steadily improve, culminating in a number of agreements that have been signed in the past couple of years, notably the double taxation agreement and the visa waiver program, both of which were signed earlier this year. The United States has also provided invaluable assistance in the resettlement of refugees, thus you could say bringing the relationship to full circle. We should also keep in mind that the bilateral relations between the two countries do not take place in a vacuum, and it's therefore important to consider the context in which the relations take place, for example, Malta's membership in the EU, and together with the shared membership that both the United States and Malta claim within the UN, OSCE, and the further flesh and dynamic that these add to their bilateral relations. So the instances in US-Maltese relations that I mentioned here, Malta's role during the Second World War and President Roosevelt's visits, not only in 1943, but also in 1945 on his way to the Yalta Conference, the reorientation of Malta's foreign policy towards non-alignment, and its role in hosting the Malta Summit in 1989. These reflect a recognition of Malta's geographic and political strategic role, which has also been an underlying aspect of Malta's relations with the US, and not only their shared political interests, but also their shared security interests. And this perhaps is also reflected by this week's visit by Senator John McCain and other members of the US Senate Armed Services Committee. So in bringing us to the primary theme of today's discussion, the USA in transition from here to where, I would argue that the transition that the USA finds itself in is one that is not only limited to domestic politics, but will also inevitably enter the realm of foreign politics. It will be interesting to see the way in which the roots of the US-Maltese relations that have brought us to what I would describe as a high point during Ambassador Bordonaro's time in Malta can be cultivated further to the mutual benefit of both countries. My questions to the ambassador would therefore be, what place is there for US-Maltese relations within and following this transition, and can the momentum that has been achieved thus far be sustained in the future? Thank you.
Many thanks, Valentina, for your introspective and revealing presentation. I would like to invite Ambassador Bordonaro to give her contribution. U.S. Ambassador Bordonaro presented her credential as United States Ambassador to Malta on September 7, 2005, to the President of the Republic of Malta. Ambassador Bordonaro is a native of Portland, Oregon. Prior to her move to Malta, she was a principal in a leading public affairs and strategic communications firm. She also worked in commercial real estate and owned her own consulting firm. She served on the board of directors of Fannie Corporation, was a co-founding director of a community investment bank that specializes in real estate development for low-income areas. Ms. Bordonaro, moreover, has a distinguished career in public service. She was a member of the U.S. Congress's Commission on the Advancement of Women in Science and Technology. She served as chair of the Pacific States for the Bush-Cheney presidential campaign in 2000. She also served on the boards of numerous civic groups, including the Portland Family of Funds, the Oregon Children's Scholarship Fund, and the Portland Center Stage. Previously, Ms. Bordonaro was a senior director for the American Legislative Exchange Council in Washington, D.C. I am particularly intrigued by this ambassador, who has been to schools, to the university a number of times and engaged in the local media, incessantly responding to questions and impending misconceptions. Her openness is laudable, and I know of very few ambassadors accredited to these islands who have shown such a forthcoming interest in our people, culture, and way of life. Amongst her major diplomatic achievements, as was mentioned by Valentina as well, her crucial role in resettling a number of migrants to the U.S., worked hard on the visa wavering program, led a number of successful commercial and policy achievements, initiated the process for U.S. firms to establish operations in Malta, and prompted the double taxation agreement. Ambassador.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Azzopardi, for those that kind introduction, and also Valentina for that excellent perspective on the thorough Maltese-U.S. relations. In fact, I learned a few things myself, and I appreciate it very much. As Dr. Azzopardi said, that I have throughout my time here frequently come to the university, and it's actually one of my favorite things to do for two reasons. Number one, as was alluded to earlier, universities around the world are really the epicenters of the type of thinking that is going on that is really the embodiment of what a mature democracy should be, where free thinking and free discussion of ideas is wielding solutions and concepts for a better future. And so I like coming to the University of Malta to be at the heart of where those discussions are taking place, and certainly to engage myself with students on those discussions. And also for the second reason, which is the obvious one, that as the world is looking at increasingly more global problems that we are facing, it is going to be up to the younger generation to tackle and face greater challenges in unique ways in a multilateral fashion, and it's up to the next generation to help solve them. So doing what we can to engage tomorrow's leaders, who are today's youth, to be a part of current events and discussions is to the betterment of the world as a whole. It's also a pleasure to be here today to share my views on the U.S. election. Let me just first start out by saying that this was truly a historical election. First of all, it was incredibly historical in the fact that the United States of America has elected its first African-American president. This is something that is wildly exciting throughout the United States, and I think throughout the world as well. Valentina referenced earlier the idea of the American dream, and there's probably no better embodiment of the American dream than having the son of a Kenyan immigrant go on to become the President of the United States of America, irregardless of his ethnic background or the color of his skin. And so it's a fine moment for the United States to be able to say amongst ourselves and possibly to the world as well that the ideas that we build our country on, that all people are equal and free and have an opportunity irrespective of background, color, or gender, is truly alive and well in the United States of America. The second reason it is so historical is because you have to go back many decades to really hearken a time when an American president was facing so many challenging issues. When Barack Obama is sworn in on January 20th, he'll be facing, probably as the unemployment numbers continue to grow, we lost 500,000 jobs in the United States in the month of November alone, could potentially be on the verge of the worst recession that we've seen in 30 to 40 years. And certainly this is growing to become a global recession as well, to current interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so there has been rare a time in our nation's history where we've had so many challenges facing a president on the day that they take the oath of office. I want to first just talk about the transition of power and what this election meant in terms of transition of power, and then try to speak a little bit about the topic of from here to where, and give an idea of possibly where President-elect Barack Obama's administration, from a policy standpoint, is likely to go. I've had a lot of questions recently about the transition of power in the United States because of the period of time between election and actually the January 20th swearing in. But really, the transition began on the same evening that the outcome of the election on November 4th became public. In fact, it was a fine moment when U.S. Senator John McCain gave his concession speech and urged his supporters to find ways to come together and work with the new administration to move America forward. Senator McCain highlighted the fact that the great issues of our day, whether overcoming the global economic slowdown or fighting the scourge of terrorism, transcend partisan politics by saying, whatever our differences, we are fellow Americans. In the same spirit, President-elect Obama reached out to Senator McCain's supporters in his victory speech, saying, I may not have won your vote tonight, but I hear your voices, and I will be your president, too. I think that this was such a great expression of how a mature democracy works in terms of, once the voters have made their decision, really coming together and finding the best ways possible to work to make our country and the world a better place. Having the benefit of just spending 2 days with Senator McCain while he was here in Malta, and by the way, he loves your country. I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back soon. As a historian, he could not get enough of the culture and history of Malta, even though he was here to do important meetings as well. But I had the benefit of speaking with Senator McCain, and it's truly a heartfelt sincerity what he described in his concession speech about his desire to work as closely as possible with President-elect Barack Obama to ensure that he can lend his support to dealing with some of these challenging issues. I think it's been also great to see in the last month how much President Bush and his administration has worked closely with the transition team of Barack Obama to do whatever they can to make President-elect Barack Obama's transition as smooth as possible. In fact, as ambassador, I too have participated in doing what I can to put everything in place to make the transition for the new ambassador that will be appointed by President-elect Barack Obama as smooth as possible, and will continue to do so even after the new ambassador is named. So I think with some sense of pride as an American, I like to highlight this incredible cooperation that takes place between the two parties once the voters have made their decision. And certainly I think in the next coming months you will see continuation of that. Over the past few weeks, President-elect Obama has announced a number of his cabinet appointments. The period of time between the election and January 20th is a period of time where we allow the president-elect to assemble the appropriate people and make the right appointments. a lot of people have asked, is this too much time or not enough time? Most experts agree that it's probably an appropriate amount of time because of the fact that we have a very different system in the United States, which isn't like a parliamentary system where you fill your cabinet with members who are already in parliament and elected and therefore have a good idea of who you're going to appoint to some of the important ministerial or cabinet positions. In the United States of America, the President of the United States has the ability to form his cabinet or his top officials, including ambassadors or any positions, from anyone he would like to. He can choose to fill it with members from academia, members of the private sector, members of the Senate, people from government. And so really it gives the President an opportunity to draw the most talented or most experienced people in each field where he deems fit. And certainly we've seen that over the past few weeks with appointments such as Senator Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State designate and Tim Geithner as the new Secretary of the Treasury. These choices, among others, are showing that he is building a team comprised of the best and the brightest of America to run our government and is being largely applauded by most Americans and members of the Congress from both parties that these individuals are incredibly capable to serve in their position and handle the complexity of the issues they're facing. In addition, President-elect Barack Obama made the decision to appoint President Bush's current Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, to continue on as his Secretary of Defense. Obviously, this is not only choosing a Republican, but choosing someone from the current Bush administration. So this once again demonstrates the fact that not only in America, but in particular, Barack Obama is not only choosing the best of the brightest, but he's doing it irrespective of what party they're from or even if they're from the current administration. He is truly concerned, I think, with putting together the best team possible. And there's no doubt that Secretary Gates has received praise from both parties over the job that he's been doing in the last 3 years and working to provide a real solution to bringing the Iraq conflict and hopefully Afghanistan as well to an end. So what does this mean? What does it mean in terms of the direction that Barack Obama is going to be going in? And I think a good sense is being drawn from both the discussions and the debates during the campaign, but also from the team that he is assembling around him. I'm going to say something that is going to possibly diffuse the idea of change, but I don't want to take away from that. But in all honesty, both in the team that he is choosing and in some of the positions that he's taking, his direction that he's going to is not going to be that dissimilar from President Bush in the last 2 years. Now, I really want to point that out when I say in the last 2 years, because there is a big difference between the Bush administration, in particular in the first term, and the Bush administration in the second term, especially in the last 2 years. I will say this, that with the start of President-elect Barack Obama, we'll begin to see what I like to term as more of the closing out of the reaction to September 11, 2001, which is largely where a lot of the policy decisions of President Bush's administration were taken in the first term. Certainly the building of Homeland Security, the issue of Guantanamo Bay, even the decision to go into Iraq, was made within a time frame where the American public was still making decisions based on the enormity of the attack of September 11th. And then Bush's last term, in particular the last few years, has been moving in a direction which I think President-elect Obama, still bringing change, will continue along much of the same path. President Bush had already announced that he would like to begin withdrawing troops within about 16 months out of Iraq, and this is a policy that Barack Obama is going to continue on. And I think that's part of the reason why Secretary Gates was asked to stay on. In addition, most of his appointments for the financial team are individuals who come from a perspective of free market and less regulatory. And while there will be a quick answer to trying to stem the financial and the economic problems that the country is facing, I think that there is a collective understanding now that by the people that he's appointing, it's not going to be a huge reaction in terms of moving towards an overreaction of regulation and increased government, but more of trying to do precision reform of important regulations, in particular with the financial sector, and infusing capital and stimulus packages to get the United States moving again, which will have a great impact on the global economy. In the areas where I think you are going to be seeing a real marked change is on the issue of climate control, which once again, this was started in the last term of the Bush administration in terms of the commitment now underway to finding a solution to the post-Kyoto UN climate control discussion that began in Bali and is going to end in Copenhagen. But there's no doubt that President-elect Barack Obama is going to be going into the conference in Copenhagen with an absolute desire to get an international consensus agreement where the United States takes a role and a part in signing an agreement on how to control climate. And I also think that you're going to see a more multilateral collaboration. Of course, even in Bush's, in the end of President Bush's term, we began to see more of this taking place. But I think that all decisions, and this is a collective lesson that was learned, of course, after the Iraq War, that in particular with the relationship between the United States and the EU, that it is not beneficial to address these global concerns without a consensus agreement, in particular to those who share the same values of trying to establish democracy and freedom around the world. But I think, and this is the direction the whole world is moving anyway, but President Barack Obama, I think, is going to assume a greater leadership role in driving multilateral communication and finding areas of agreement between not only the EU and the U.S., but the entire world on how do we eradicate poverty, how do we deal with increasing prosperity in Africa, how do we deal with potential pandemic diseases, and, of course, climate change. And so I think that really a marked difference in the Barack Obama administration is going to be this increased communication. Well, as I alluded to earlier as well, there's going to be a change from ambassador to ambassador to Malta. And there is no doubt that I think the next ambassador will build upon the foundations that have been put in place, as I was able to build upon the foundations that were put in place between my predecessors. We were able, for a multitude of different reasons, to have some great successes, as Valentina referred to, during the last 3.5 years, including the extradition treaty, a PSI shipboarding agreement, helping customs build their operations at the Freeport with a new warehouse and their screening machine, creating a joint search and rescue training center that is now working to train Coast Guards and navies all throughout Africa and the Mediterranean here in Malta, sponsored by the United States, a double taxation agreement, the visa waiver program, which, by the way, is going to be announced next week, and also really responding to the call of Malta to aid in the help of resettling refugees and helping your country maintain an appropriate proportion of refugees that are coming to Malta, and also standing side by side to deal with what potentially could become more of a humanitarian issue. And so I'm pleased that from May to the end of this year, we will have resettled about 200 refugees to the United States. But our commitment moving forward is that this will be an ongoing permanent program, of which we will continue to hopefully resettle up to 50 a month. In addition, the commercial relationship has really strengthened in the last few years. Currently, one out of every 50 Maltese work for an American firm, and that doesn't even account the numerous franchises or partial investments. But this is becoming two-way as well. We're seeing Maltese firms like EC invest in the United States. And so I think the next ambassador will be given an opportunity to really focus on building the commercial relationship as we continue to become a globalized economy, but also as Malta becomes such a unique opportunity for foreign investment or American investment in particular because of your geographic location, English-speaking, and highly, highly educated and highly skilled workforce. Another area which I think will continue to see great involvement between our two countries is what I like to call academic diplomacy. And We have expanded during my term here the Fulbright program in the United States, where we bring over professors to help in both teaching specific curriculums, but also in overall curriculum development. And even more exciting, we've announced two joint master's degree programs between the University of Malta and American universities, both dealing with 21st century cutting-edge master's programs such as environmental sustainable technological development and also communications and marketing. I could mention many, many more activities that are being worked on and which the next ambassador will build on, but I have no doubt that whether it's increasing to work in a partnership on security issues in the Mediterranean or academic diplomacy or commercial issues, that the United States and Malta, as seen historically, but also moving in the future, will have a unique relationship and an important bilateral relationship going forward for many, many years in the future. On a personal note, I just want to say that this has been an incredible experience for me personally, being able to live here in Malta and be able to represent my country. I have three small children, and I know my greatest concern when I first came here was I thought maybe I'd be able to cope as an ambassador, but I was a little bit worried as a mom about my children acclimating to Malta, and it has exceeded all expectations, mostly because the Maltese people, I think, are the most friendly, open, incredible, welcoming people possibly in the world. And my children and my husband and I have made a tremendous amount of friends. And so when our time comes to an end in the next few months, it'll be very difficult to say goodbye to many of our friends. And we will always consider Malta as our second home. But I just want to say thank you to all the Maltese people who really are the best asset of this country. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I would like to invite the people here, students, colleagues, and other guests, to contribute to this discussion. The ambassador really wanted to engage with questions or comments or queries that students or any other colleagues here would like to discuss. There's a roving mic because this public lecture will be transmitted on Campus FM as well. So if you don't mind, I'll pass on the mic to people who would like to contribute.
I'd like to congratulate both speakers for their excellent presentations. My question to the ambassador, perhaps also taking you back to a more partisan mindset, is where do you think will the Republican Party go now after the recent electoral defeat? And another question is, what role do you think Governor Palin played in the last elections?
That is a very good question. And quite frankly, Senator McCain and I spent some time talking about this when he was here. I mean, this goes beyond just being an ambassador. Is this like on the record or off the record?
We can edit.
No, it's fine. I mean, obviously what I'd say back home as well. I mean, I'm speaking more as maybe a Republican than as an ambassador in saying this, but clearly it was a resounding defeat for the Republicans. And, you know, that's what democracy is all about, is about the opportunity if the public is dissatisfied to make wholesale changes like that. And so I think it really forces the Republican Party to go back and rethink some of its policies. One of the things that Senator McCain and I both agreed upon, that I am adamant that the Republican Party is not going to be a majority party, is if we continue along this path of angry anti-immigration. And this was certainly one of the tones of this last election. And we resoundingly lost the Hispanic vote. And it's increasingly becoming an incredibly important vote in the United States. And in fact, if you would have just added in the differences that Bush got to what McCain got in the Hispanic vote, that could have potentially made a difference. Most definitely in the overall popular vote. Maybe I haven't seen the state-by-state breakdowns. But not only for political reasons would that be good policy. I mean, we're a nation that has been built on immigration. And while, yes, there is a desire to make sure that illegal activity such as illegal immigration does not take place, I think it's critically important the tone and the rhetoric in which this debate is being discussed. And I'm quite nervous about the fact that the tone and the tenor of some of the debate coming out of the Republican Party is very much being viewed by minority constituencies in the United States as being anti-immigrant and slightly potentially prejudiced. And I think that's very dangerous. This is not what the United States is about, and I would like to see the Republican Party once again be the party of Ronald Reagan and be the party of openness. I mean, he was the one that granted amnesty for Hispanic migrants in the United States and talked about the greatness of what the United States symbolized. And there's no doubt that immigration is one of the reasons why our economy grew so significantly in the last four decades. And by the way, it's a policy that Senator McCain also supported, but one of the policies that got him into so much trouble with part of the Republican Party, which he was having difficulty with. So the issue of Sarah Palin, you know, honestly, I think who is going to become a leader in the Republican Party in the United States is yet to be seen. I think Sarah Palin does have a lot of Republicans who are very supportive of her. I think she speaks to some of the divisions in the Republican Party directly in terms of who is supportive of her and some of the divisions that I'm alluding to and what I'm talking about. So I think there's going to have to be some soul searching, because I honestly believe that if the Republican Party is going to be a majority party, it's going to have to take a leader that not only reaches out to all Republicans, but reaches out to independents as well and Democrats. And quite frankly, that's what Barack Obama was able to do. That's where other Republicans have had their successes. Oh, and let me just, I don't mean to ramble, but can I have a moment, because this reminds me of something, because I had in my speech to talk about the youth movement. And I just want to take this moment to talk about the youth movement, because this is going to be the deciding factor in, you know, really if the Republican Party can rebuild itself. Because I fear we've really lost the youth in this last election, and the youth overwhelmingly came out to vote for Barack Obama. Today, the fastest growing party in the United States are independents. And we're seeing this around the world. You guys are seeing this to somewhat of an extent here in Malta as well. Young people tend to be less partisan. They tend to be more pragmatic. They want to see the issues get done. They want to see them addressed. They aren't as so beholden to the debate of yesteryear, which was founded on huge ideological differences of the time of the Cold War, when it was socialism versus free markets. Now young people are looking to a pragmatic leadership to get these issues done. And so I'm not quite sure that I can see a leader in the Republican Party right now emerging that is capable of not only attracting all Republicans, but also these independent youth that clearly are swaying elections, not only in America, but around the world.
I associate myself with the comments about the good speeches. A few questions, if I may. Do you think that President Barack Obama will be more protectionist than Bush? And have been seeing that not only in the United States, but also many other governments, they are protecting depositors. What about investors, shareholders? Are there any thinking about protecting also shareholders who invest their money so that the economy will grow? Thank you.
In regards to the first part of your question, in terms of protectionism, there was some concern of those who are strong advocates of free trade that in particular in the Democratic primary, he was to the left of Hillary Clinton during that primary in terms of the issue of free trade. He openly stated that he actually openly criticized Hillary Clinton in her role in supporting agreements such as NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, which facilitates free trade in North America between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. I mean, obviously our unions have a large say in this, because they view the idea that greater protectionism will potentially save some of the manufacturing jobs. Clearly, globalization is changing so much of that, and the opportunity in terms of growth and prosperity has been demonstrated in terms of opening up markets, not closing markets, as well as providing greater prosperity, quite frankly, to other countries around the world, in particular third world countries. I mean, the greatest thing that we can do to eradicate poverty around the world is to create freer and fair trade. I think agricultural subsidies is a great example of that. One of the greatest things that we could do in terms of helping Africa, Maine, reach greater prosperity is to create fair trade where prosperous nations stop subsidizing agriculture and allow third world countries to compete. But that said, Barack Obama has already backed off a lot of his positions in regards to the perceived anti-free trade, and he's couched them more as a pragmatist saying, I want to see free trade agreements going forward having more protections in them in terms of labor in other countries, so they're more on an even platform with the labor protections that we have in our own country, and also environmental protections as well. I think it would be impossible for an American president to be ever termed in the 21st century as a protectionist. So while I think President Barack Obama will not be as aggressive in pushing for free trade agreements as the Bush administration was, and were able to get CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and other agreements moving forward, as well as maintaining on an annual basis the free trade agreement with China, I think that you'll see a much more cautious approach on moving forward on free trade agreements, but still the momentum towards greater free trade. I give such long-winded answers. I can't remember your second question.
Protection for shareholders.
Oh, protection for shareholders. You mean shareholders of publicly traded companies? Yeah. Well, you know that we already had addressed that with Sarbanes-Oxley, which happened after the Enron failure, where a tremendous amount of Americans who held public stock in company Enron lost a tremendous amount of money when Enron went under. And so Sarbanes-Oxley is a requirement of publicly traded companies to have a higher elevation of transparency and financial reporting and greater independence amongst its board of directors. I think more what you're going to see is because Sarbanes-Oxley was so thorough on the side of shareholder protection, instead what you're going to see is some financial regulatory changes, in particular to the credit markets, in terms of underwriting of the amount of reserves that need to be kept by financial institutions as a percentage to the amount that they are using for loans, as well as some accounting principles regarding mark-to-market in other ways. So I really think that we're going to see a lot of change in the financial regulation, but I think that there is a consensus that a lot of the shareholder protection was addressed within Sarbanes-Oxley.
Kevin?
During the Cold War, there was this bipolar situation, right, between the United States and the Soviet Russia, whatever, USSR. And there was this phenomenon of both powers, that they were keeping tabs on each other. Now, that has finished, thank God, and now we have a new situation. With the excuse of the war on terror, it seems that the United States has created again a bipolar situation, but this time without the tabs. That was my first, I mean, what do you think about this?
Without
the tabs, I mean, they were first keeping tabs on each other, the two powers, okay? And now there don't seem to be any tabs of any sort. Now, I wonder whether you agree with this or not. And my second question is that we appreciate, of course, the commitment that America has to bring democracy to countries which do not have it. However, why does it seem that this commitment seems only applicable to countries that have certain amount of resources like oil and so on.
Okay, your first question in terms of in the post-Cold War, can you explain about the United States is making decisions without keeping tabs? Is that?
Yes, I mean, there's nobody to keep tabs anymore. The Soviet Union has finished.
Oh, I see. You're saying that there's no one to, like, balance the power? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, there's only one superpower, which seems to be...
No, I understand. I understand. Okay, great. No, I understand now. It's never been the desire of the United States of America to be a superpower. In fact, that's why we spend a vast amount of our taxpayer resources around the world to build other institutions and countries and to make them prosperous and successful. I mean, historically, that's always been our take, from the reason we intervened in World War II to the fact that immediately after World War II, we almost bankrupted the United States through the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe, because we wanted Europe to be as strong and prosperous as the United States of America. And if you look at any intervention around the world that the United States has ever taken, we've never done it to rule or expand. And actually, quite frankly, we're the only country throughout history of the world that has never tried to increase its geographical size or put in place colonies. We actually engage in every action with the hope and desire, including what's going on in Iraq, to build them up to be as prosperous and as sovereign as possible so that they can self-rule in a democratic fashion. In fact, our guiding principles simply are the fact that we believe that every human being on Earth should have the ability, through a democratic system, to have control over their own destiny as a human rights value. And so it's our hope that the future of the world will be one of multilateral cooperation amongst strong countries like the EU, like China, like India. Of course, we want them all to share values of making sure that every one of their citizens has freedom and freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of prosperity through economic free markets. So, I mean, that is the goal. You know, in terms of this war on terror, obviously these transnational threats, where it's terrorism or drugs or proliferation, the United States, no doubt, is working in a multilateral fashion, whether they're constantly sharing information or working collaboratively. Let's just take Iran, for example. I mean, it's a serious threat. If Iran gains nuclear weapons, it's going to completely change the balance of power in the Middle East, and it's probably not a good idea to have a regime like that, or any regime, gaining nuclear proliferation. But the United States has gone about this issue by working in a collaborative fashion, not only with the EU, but with Russia as well, and are in constant communications, which started out with the IAEA, then the EU3, and now the UN Security Council, in trying to find diplomatic solutions to prevent Iran from gaining sanctions. Now, the issue of Iraq. You know, I definitely would disagree with any notion that the reason we went into Iraq or any other country is because that they have oil reserves. It certainly hasn't benefited access. In fact, we're working very hard to build up their oil capacity to turn it back over to the Iraqi people so that they can finance themselves and their government and their country so that we can stop spending the billions of dollars of taxpayer money that we're currently spending to help rebuild their country. Clearly that there was a, I mean, this is very open, there was a belief at the time that Iraq posed a security threat. There's also been a very stated process that the United States, and this is part of the democratic process of this election and the decision, that intelligence was wrong. And President Bush has said that obviously mistakes were made because the intelligence was wrong. And where a threat was perceived to be immediately important was clearly not. So, you know, moving forward, I think the United States is still going to play an incredibly important role in the world in terms of working in fighting for human rights and for all people to hopefully one day live in countries where they have the freedom and democracies that you get to enjoy and that I get to enjoy as an American and you get to enjoy as a Maltese. But I think it's always been the goal of the United States to work in a multilateral fashion, and we'll continue to do so.
Thanks. Good evening. Again, thanks again for the very interesting speeches. I'm from the education background, and I like the way you termed, you know, the U.S. Maltese relations as also having built strong academic diplomacy, in a sense, and continuing doing that, aiming to continue doing that. I'm just going to take the discussion a little bit on a tangent here, in the sense, and pardon this might sound like a cliche, but oftentimes when, you know, Maltese people are speaking about Americans, we kind of actually praise their very entrepreneurial approach and their entrepreneurial skills. And it's interesting to see and hear maybe my fellow Maltese compatriots here might disagree with me again, but we kind of see Maltese people being very entrepreneurial abroad, especially in the U.S., for example, but maybe less so in Malta itself. And my question is, what do you feel, perhaps, I know this might be like a tough question, but what do you feel exists in the U.S. environment, putting it very broadly, you know, politically, etc., which actually, you know, really motivates people to be entrepreneurial? Is it within the schooling system? Is it, you know, within the political system? If you could just kind of give us some insight as to what you feel about this.
Sure. And it's such a timely question because I just brought over a Maltese delegation to the United States in particular, Austin, Texas, which has a great center for entrepreneurial support. And I'm working now with the Maltese government to try to create a similar center here. To answer your question, there's really two things in the United States that sets us apart because human beings in the power of their ideas is basically where an entrepreneurial begins. And there's no difference between a Maltese or an American in terms of being able to generate those type of ideas to make life or the quality of life better or to improve things. But there's some very distinct things in the United States, and I would say that they're twofold. First, we do have a series of systems in place that will help any American who has a good idea actually take it to a commercial marketplace. And this goes all the way to academic institutions which teach entrepreneurial ideas, to systems of financing to be able to actually finance a product or an idea, where it's venture capital or it's investment banking or it's angel investors, to also an opportunity to access a greater marketplace. And then the second thing is that we have role models, which is really a powerful thing, because in America, everybody wants to potentially be the next Bill Gates or the next now Barack Obama, where you can really see the power through role models, the fact that so many children sitting in classrooms across the United States really believe that they can dream and achieve, that they can be that person or that. And that's really powerful because that creates a lot of the initiative or the moxie or the belief in oneself that you can move forward and take that chance or that risk on a good idea. So I'm working with the Maltese right now, and there's some interest amongst the government to create a center for global entrepreneurship here that would foster those same type of systems to help Maltese become more entrepreneurial. Focusing on everything with instruction on how do you develop a business plan, how do you take a product to market, to helping Maltese actually find investors beyond Malta, but looking at international financing mechanisms, whether it's venture capital or angel investors or others, and also extending education in terms of being entrepreneurial-minded, not only at the university level, but down into the school level as well. But then also using role models as mentors and advisors at this Center for Global Entrepreneurship. I'm really excited about it. I don't know if it's going to take off. It's really in the initial stages, but I'm continuing to be engaged, you know, in my final months here is trying to do what I can to push this through. And I'm really pleased that they chose to come to America as a source for how they put this together here in Malta. So I hope it happens because there's so much potential. And now that you're a member of the EU, your marketplace is beyond the 400,000 that are in Malta, but really the 400,000 million that are in the European marketplace.
We have time for just the last.
I mean, this is an ongoing social debate within our country about the issue of protecting human life and what it means in terms of protecting human life. There is a difference on policy between President-elect Barack Obama and President Bush. President Bush took policies and actually worked on those policies to advance a position from the federal government that was very aggressive at trying to protect human life through its continuum, starting with, you know, abortion, trying to modify some abortion with parental notification, mostly which takes place at the state level, but obviously the federal funding for research using embryonic cells. This is a position that President-elect Barack Obama has already said that he probably would like to reverse within his first few months in office on the federal funding of embryonic cells for research. So there is going to be a difference. You know, this is an ongoing debate within our country as it is within the global community in terms of what is the definition of human rights. And I think while some people are going to say President-elect Barack Obama is better on human rights because he's going to close Guantanamo Bay, others are going to say he's worse on human rights because he's going to begin federal funding for embryonic cell research. You know, I think this is a good debate to be taking place in the United States. And a lot of people I hear at times say, this is wrong, you know, I don't want these social issues being debated. But there's probably nothing more fundamental than in a mature society discussing how we value human beings. And so I look forward to a continuing debate that is probably never going to resolve itself fully, but continue to evolve in terms of finding a better understanding, certainly especially in a global community, of what humanity and human rights truly means. And I certainly hope that the American people will continue to engage in this debate from the standpoint of the value of human life.
I'm going back from my word, but I can take the last question from the UTCOM representative and Maria, and maybe somebody can put pass on. Thank you. And she's also the rep of the 4 tiers.
I'm not a very technological person, so I just freak out when this thing goes off. I just wanted to bring back the young people's perspective into all this debate. Just looking around, our perceptions of what we come across through from America, what is America, what people perceive to be America, the American president. I came across this song. I just like to quote some verses from it. Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me. Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask some questions if we can speak honestly. Another part says, how can you say no child is left behind? And it ends, dear Mr. President, you'd never take a walk with me, would you? It does reflect, in a way, the sentiment of the American young people in America within these past few years. How does this equate with the concept in the constituency of America in pursuit of happiness, which is quite a very different, shall we say, outlook? One is speaking, we have no communication with the president. There's nothing we can say with the presidency, with parliament, with all those in power that reflect us. And yet, up there, they are supposed to be in the pursuit of happiness of every citizen, every American citizen. How would this equate, and how would this transition to the Obama presidency figure in?
First of all, that's one of the great things I love about the Maltese is that they always find great expressions through the cultural aspects of the art to talk about policy. So I appreciate your use of a song to discuss that, because it's a wonderful way to elevate discussion on important issues. You know, I think this election is very demonstrative of the fact that the American people do have a say and have direct line of communication with our leaders. They can choose to keep them in power, choose not to keep them in power. And I think that the issues over the course of this election were very clear through the primaries and everything. I mean, John McCain won the Republican primary as a moderate pragmatic. Barack Obama won the primary as somebody who was not a Washington insider against a Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama won the general election as someone who was promising change. So I think the American people and the American youth are very happy right now with the systems in place in the United States that allow them to speak directly to an American president. Clearly, when you have a population of 380 million people, you can't each have an independent dialogue with the United States president. But through a great and powerful democracy like this, you can have conversations. And I kept hearing people, especially when I go back home, saying, this election is so long. It's taking a year and a half. And Maltese would say, gosh, that's a long election. Ours is only like 45 days. And I would say, you know what? That's the power of this democracy, which I'm so proud about, because these candidates, when they were running for president, went to every state. They went to some states more than 20 times. They were in communities. They were in schools. I mean, they spent a year and a half having a direct conversation with the American people and hearing back from them, and through the primary process and then the general election and open discussion and open debates were really an engagement of collectively having youth, all of Americans, 380 million, really have an opportunity to have a say in what direction they want their country to go in. And their voice was heard loud and clear. And I think out of it, you can take away very clear specifics of what the American people want. They want change. They don't want politics as usual. They want less partisanship. They want new ideas. They want collaborative, multilateral work on issues facing global challenges. And they want solutions. They don't want to hear about why we can't deal with climate change. They don't want to hear with why we can't and the problems in Iraq. They just want solutions. And I think that's what you're going to get, or at least where this administration, this new administration, is going to go. So I would write a new song talking about the great hope and opportunity that the United States of America continually provides American citizens through the power of its democratic process. And today, most Americans are, despite a bad economy, despite challenges in the world, are truly inspired and hopeful.
Thank you. If that tune is on a heavy metal...
It's rap.
Okay. I would have asked Albert to do that. But
how do you know what percentage of the voters, what percentage of the votes was given by youths? That means how many youths voted in this election? As against non-youth?
I can't give you the specific percentage, and it's how you define youth. Is it under 30, under, you know, 20? But I will tell you this, that it was the highest turnout of young voters, and also the highest turnout of newly registered voters ever in the history of the country. So those two numbers just in itself, I think, speak volumes about you know, where young people are playing a role, and you know, first-time registered voters are playing a role in the outcome of elections in America.
Yes, because I believe it even affected the case that a colored man was elected. Now, what percentage of the voters was white?
I think it was very much mirrored the percentage of African Americans in our country, which I think is 10%. I mean I think it closely reflected just the percentage of African Americans as a population.
But you can't say, for example, 50% of voters were white, 50% of voters were colored.
Yeah, I mean, I can't because I don't know the statistics off the top of my head. But if you give me your information, I can get you. Those are statistics are readily available.
Yes. Thank you very much. Many thanks to Valentina and to all the students and the guests who attended. Thank you, Ambassador, for your openness and candidness. As usual, you have responded to our questions without being apologetic or defensive. It has been a pleasure having such an intricate discussion. I would like to thank Campus FM as well for recording this event in its outside lecture series. I wish you all the very best in this festive season and wish the U.S. Ambassador the best of luck in all she plans on doing following her tenure in this role. And I would like to announce as well that in January we should be having Ambassador Gideon Meyer, the Israeli ambassador, who will be doing a similar event sometime in January. So thank you very much. Now, if we're quick enough, we can catch a shop or two that are still open. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled The USA in Transition, From Here to Where. This talk was delivered by U.S. Ambassador Ms. Molly Bordonaro.